Welcome to the finale of the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Throughout 2024, we have been celebrating the 30-year anniversary of the Chicago-Hamburg Sister City Partnership. Today, I'd like to take you through some of the highlights of our year exploring the history, culture, and people of Chicago, the literature of Chicago, the sound of Chicago, the role of German immigrants in shaping Chicago, and the rich connections between the great cities of Chicago and Hamburg. Let's start with episode 3, where we heard from Professor John Lowe, member of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians. The Potawatomi inhabited the Chicago region when European settlers first arrived. It's important to remember that the land on which Chicago rests was first indigenous land. And here's John describing his tribe's cultural and spiritual relationship to Chicago.
I wrote a book called Imprints, the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi in the City of Chicago, that outlines our constant connections to the City of Chicago and that we've never given those connections up, and we maintain those connections to this day, for which I'm very proud. I was just going to say, I was always taught that Chicago is a part of our homeland. It's where we walk on the bones of our ancestors, and we say that with pride. Because what that means is that we've been here for so long that there's nowhere that you can walk. There hasn't been a Potawatomi person before you.
After learning about the indigenous history of Chicago, we then learned about the first German settlers in Chicago when the town was officially founded in 1833. Many of the first Chicagoans were from German-speaking parts of Europe, and we realize that it is problematic to use the phrase German immigrants to describe them because Germany did not yet exist. Instead, these people all spoke German, were culturally German, but they came from different duchies, principalities, and imperial territories, such as regions within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Here's our expert on Germanic immigrants in Chicago, Dr. Sebastian Wupper, discussing the first voting information we have from the first elections in Chicago when it officially became a city in 1837.
So I would start by saying that when Chicago officially received its city charter from the state of Illinois in 1837, the voter rolls for the first mayoral election already contained 13 German names. And that is only those Germans who knew enough English and who were eligible to vote, and also the ones who made an effort to actually cast a ballot. So we have 13 German names in the first election, and we can assume, or at least the early German historians who write histories of German Chicago in the 1880s, then list altogether about 30 German names among the earliest settlers.
So about 30 out of these 200, perhaps.
Yeah.
So that's a significant amount, yeah.
And then in 1839, you have someone who's either Carl or Clemens. The first name is not, like, sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other, so it's not entirely certain. But C. Stoße, who was the first German-American who was elected to the position of alderman. We do not know which party he belonged to, as the pertinent records onto that were lost in the Great Fire of 1871. And that should also be a side note. If we talk about the early history of Chicago, it tends to be an issue that this Great Fire burned so many things up, because that ends up making the records a little spotty.
In February, we celebrated African American History Month with an episode on Black Chicago. We learned that the first non-Indigenous settler was a Black man from Haiti by the name of Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable. Du Sable opened a trading post on the Chicago River sometime in the 1780s. In this episode, we also learned about the richness of Black culture in Chicago throughout history. Here's our expert guest, Mary Patillo, professor of sociology and Black studies at Northwestern University, reading a poem by the great Black Chicago poet, Gwendolyn Brooks.
Black artists have also obviously not said that Black folks have been in Chicago for always, but, you know, we have blended with the land. We have blended with the place. And so I'm just going to read a stanza from Gwendolyn Brooks, who is Chicago's famed Black poet. And this is from a poem called Primer for Blacks. And she writes, quote, "Blackness stretches over the land. Blackness, the black of it, the rust red of it, the milk and cream of it, the tan and yellow tan of it, the deep brown, middle brown, high brown of it, the olive and ochre of it. Blackness marches on." I just love that poem for bringing in all of the shades of blackness, bringing in this connection to the land, bringing in this presence that Black Chicago still has.
In March, we celebrated Women's History Month with two episodes about the activist and philanthropist Jane Addams, who did more to nurture Chicago communities than perhaps any other person in the history of the city. Jane Addams was an activist for women's rights, children's rights, immigrants' rights, and workers' rights. She was also a pacifist and a staunch supporter of the rights of women and children during wartime. She was heavily criticized for organizing shipments of humanitarian aid to the German people during World War I, despite the fact that these women and children were technically enemies. Here are our expert guests, Adams biographer Rima Lunin Schultz and Anne Durkin Keating, professor of history at North Central College, discussing Adams' complex life and her towering legacy on the city.
But it's all part of who this woman was. She's a complicated woman. I have spent, a long time, maybe 30 years. I don't know. Anne, how long have I spent?
Easily 30 years.
Living with this woman. And, you know, every time I get to the end of the life, which I am now, I start to cry. I'm crying. She remains an enigmatic figure. She is a complicated figure. American history is complicated. It deserves our attention. She was not the type of person who took a lot of time with self-care and worry about who she was in the world. Though some people have thought that she had a lot of ambition. Well, maybe she did. But she was also a person of tremendous depth.
Anne, do you want to make a final point?
Yeah, when trying to sum up Jane Addams, one of the reasons why she continues to engage me, not as long as she has engaged Rima, but certainly engage me, is the idea that she always worked for a common good, that she was not self-interested. And I think that speaks to what Rima was just relating. And that's an unusual thing, to find someone that over and over and over in whatever arena you look at, she's really looking at a common good over self-interest. The thing that complicates this, of course, is that she got to decide for us what the common good was. That is, that she, it goes back to the stewardship that she held with, that she got from yes. her dad. And that is that it was an elite view that she had the ability to discern what was for the common good, even as she understood that she needed to be in the neighborhood and she needed to be talking to the Greek, even from her hospital bed in Baltimore. She still was making those decisions on her own. And I think we wrestle with that. And I think we wrestle with that more broadly in Chicago and in the United States. But she towers. I mean, Victoria Bissell Brown, her biographer in Women Building Chicago, Rima's volume, you know, she talks about her being a tower. She towers over Chicago history. Jane Addams does. And I really think that that's not hyperbole. That's absolutely the case. There's no other person like her in Chicago history.
In April, we celebrated National Poetry Month, and we had a full episode on the previously mentioned poet Gwendolyn Brooks and another on Carl Sandburg. Here is our guest host of the Literature of Chicago episodes, Dr. Douglas Cowie, reading from Carl Sandburg's famous 1916 poem titled Chicago.
Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked and I believe them, for I've seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked and I answer yes, it is true, I have seen the gunmen kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer, and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted heads, singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth, under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing. Laughing, the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation.
In May, we celebrated Jewish American History Month with episodes about Jewish Chicago. Dr. Cowie hosted an episode on the author and Nobel laureate Saul Bellow, and another on the great Jewish journalist, a historian of the people of Chicago, Studs Terkel. But this next clip is from Tobias Brinkmann, professor of Jewish studies at Penn State University, summarizing what Chicago means for Jewish people.
I think the Jewish story, like that of Poles, Czechs, you know, German speakers, Scandinavians, is one of entering a city of opportunities, as I always call it. Chicago is a gateway city for people from all over the world, and Jews were part of it, and and this is important, they participated, they helped to build this place, to make it a better place, and some were also not so good, like the gangsters, but in a way they also filled a niche and responded to needs that existed. And I think it's overwhelmingly a really positive story. So overall, I think it's from a Jewish perspective, Chicago is a success story.
In June, we celebrated LGBTQ History Month with an episode on queer Chicago. Although New York and San Francisco are more well known as queer cities, Chicago has been extremely important in the establishment of protections for the LGBTQ community. Here is queer historian Owen Keenan discussing how important it is to preserve stories about the struggle of this community to gain equal rights in Chicago.
I think for me, I think of queer history in Chicago as sort of this quest not to assimilate, but maybe a quest to coexist as something separate from the whole. I think the only way to reclaim this history is when you can, is to get the firsthand oral history experiences, get them where they start recording them from diaries, things like that, because a lot of times if we rely upon the mainstream press, especially when it comes to raids and all the politics of gay bars and dens of perversion, you know, the title alone sort of tells you the perspective it's going to take. So it's a very exciting time to be a queer historian because you're reclaiming like all the history that we never had a chance to have told because it was always being told by someone on the outside, you know. So people like Timothy who come and, you know, write this book called Queer Cloud on the movement in Chicago from a queer perspective is just, it's a reclaiming of history.
Also in June, we chose to address the elephant in the room, Chicago's reputation for organized crime and violence. Our guests were Chicago police officer, now retired, and professor of criminology at Loyola University, Robert Lombardo, and a researcher in organized crime, Joe Kraus from the University of Scranton. Here's Joe describing the tension between the glorification of the mafia in popular culture while acknowledging the importance of organized crime in the true and real history of Chicago.
Well, when I first moved to the city, my uncle used to say to me, he says, Joe, this is the name of this county isn't Cook County. It's Crook County. Somebody just stole the R. And so I think the sense of there's been such a tradition of corruption and violence, the whole Chicago bang bang, that part of the charm of the city is our ability to remember these stories. They're not fun stories. And I really do mean it when I say someone like Robert is a hero. These are the bad guys. I don't want to celebrate them, but they're a huge part of the city. They shape the city. Many people who were not really bad guys were allowed themselves to be brought into their midst and influenced by them. So it's an important part of the story that we tell as a city. And so I want to tell that story without celebrating them, just sort of acknowledging it's part of the weather, right? Part of the historical weather of this city, part of what shapes us. So I would want to end on that note. It's never about celebrating them and singing their praises, but I also think it's important not to forget them and remember that this is a part of what makes this city such an unusual and striking place.
In July, we turned to the music of Chicago with a special three-part mini-series about the great avant-garde music tradition. Check out those three episodes with Douglas Cowie and DJ Kara Slim Roosh. These episodes feature recordings from the world-famous artists Anthony Braxton and Cahil El-Zabar, courtesy of CIMP Records. Check those out in the podcast feed. You'll really like the music. In August of 2024, the Democratic National Convention returned to Chicago, and we featured an episode about the infamous 1968 convention, where peaceful anti-Vietnam War protesters were subjected to police violence. We were fortunate to have as a guest Professor Emeritus from the University of Maryland, Gary Kissick. Gary witnessed the protests and the police riot firsthand as a young anti-war protester in 1968. Here's Gary describing his memories of 68 as he and his two young female companions found themselves facing the buzzsaw of baton-wielding Chicago police.
I saw Norman Mailer standing on the pavement watching us go by. I assume we chanted "No More War" or "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" I'm not sure. But I remember feeling subsumed by the historical moment, reveling in committing myself to a cause. And of course, this was too good to last. We came up against the police blocking our way. That was inevitable. The Poor People's Mule Train was allowed to pass because it had a permit. I never saw them again. I shouted, "Don't worry, Mom, it's only America." And that got a big cheer. And that's the last happy moment I remember. Suddenly, the police surged forward. The next thing I knew, we were trapped between them and the base of the Hilton Hotel, though I was unaware of where I was at the time. and the Hilton Hotel was where candidates had their headquarters. They squeezed us closer and closer in a human vice. It was absolutely nothing we could do to escape. And I was worried about the girls. They were such skinny things. And it was awkward to hold hands because I was taller than they were. But we were holding hands not to lose each other until the pressure just got too intense and it seemed safer to not hold hands at all. We were wondering, do they really mean to crush us to death? When is this going to let up? Dell screamed and others screamed. Bones were about to be broken. They were pushing us off the street against the walls, but we could move no further. And still the pressure increased and clubs were flying. When suddenly the protesters in the back were pushed through a plate glass window. We didn't quite know what was happening, but that sudden release of pressure was a blessing to those of us not lying in shards of broken glass. And that's when all hell broke loose and we managed to flee down the street. And the police pursued with a vengeance. I remember three cops jumped a CBS reporter and started beating him. Confiscated his camera, I think. They just hated hippies and liberals and pampered college kids, and they were going to show us who was boss. And I'm quite sure that a lot of those beaten up were not protesters at all, but simply people on the street. I read reports that we were tear gassed at the hotel. I don't remember the tear gas at all, but I have heard that Hubert Humphrey complained about the tear gas floating up to his headquarters. Anyhow, I lost the girls. I had lost them even while we were being crushed. Now we were being pursued. Some would go into the side streets like Jackson shouting slogans. I never saw anyone with a rock in their hands, certainly not a Molotov cocktail or any weapon whatsoever. We hadn't come prepared for violence.
In September, we celebrated Latin American or Hispanic Heritage Month with an episode on Hispanic Chicago. Hispanics have always been woven into the fabric of the city, and in this episode, we explored their rich cultural heritage. Here's one of our guests, Elena Gonzalez, curator of civic engagement and social justice at the Chicago History Museum, discussing the current situation and outlook for Hispanic Chicagoans.
This is a very young population overall, so I think we're going to see even more prominence, even more leadership, even more engagement across the city as this population, as the younger generation grows up. This population is local, right? Like 80% of the population was born here. So I like to dispel notions of this constant sort of feeling of foreignness because that's just not accurate. We think of indigeneity in Chicago and we think of this being a very indigenous city among cities in the United States. It's important to remember that the Latino population is a part of that because there are so many different folks of Latin American heritage in Chicago who are indigenous and identify as indigenous first and aren't thought of when we think of that indigenous population in Chicago all the time. Lilia mentioned sort of displacement, and it is worth noting that, you know, although roughly a third of Chicago is Latine, even more folks in the suburbs are Latine. And that's not a way of saying there's a smaller population in Chicago. That's a way of saying there's an even larger population in Chicagoland. And then finally, since you asked about our perspective as women, I will just say that I see women as leaders in all of these areas, as Livia mentioned, you know, politically, in the arts, in education, in the health sciences, and it's very exciting.
In October, we celebrated German-American Heritage Month with a special episode about a young German immigrant from Hamburg, Walter Heinzen, told through the memories of his grandson, John Heinzen. Walter was a German soldier, one of the first aerial photographers in the First World War. But after the war, he emigrated to Chicago, where he opened a photography studio. Many years later, John was looking through some family photos and found two photographs of American and British prisoners of war taken by his grandfather after the Battle of Cambrai. He decided to track down the relatives of these young men to give them some peace and closure. John's quest to find these relatives is the subject of his documentary films. And here's John describing his concept of peace through forgiveness after the wars.
Well, so I have two photographs. I have a group of British prisoners, 30 British prisoners, but I also have a group of 9 American prisoners. And these are the very first Americans to ever face the Germans in World War I. And they were railroad engineers from New York City. And so this engineering unit, which is very highly decorated, was assigned to the British. And when the British attacked with these tanks, they damaged these railroad tracks. And so what happened was they were working on the tracks. When the Germans counterattacked, they literally came over the hill and they threw down their shovels, picked up rifles, and engaged the Germans. A third were killed, a third were captured, and a third got away. And I have the photograph that has been mostly lost to history of the 9 Americans that were captured. And I have their Red Cross records. And so I know they survived the war. I know they came home. And so I am working to meet their families today, to present the photograph to them, and then to find out who these men were. Who were they and what were they all about and what was their war experience like? And really to keep them alive by bringing back their story. And so in the case of the British photograph, what happened was in November of 2018, I decided I was going to be in London for the anniversary, not Paris. And so I was working with a writer who was helping me with research in a British charity. And we actually found one of the people in the British photo, a man by the name of Captain Thomas Box from Liverpool. And we went to Liverpool and we met his granddaughter. And she did not know her grandfather. He had died in the 1940s, but we brought him back to life for her. And that was just such a wonderful experience. We got on the national news and in all of the papers on the anniversary of World War I. And it was just this great experience seeing this idea, you know, in the spirit of Mandela about defining peace through forgiveness. Like, what better way to give remembrance to this lost generation of men on all sides and make it a message of peace for the future? Wouldn't it be great for these men to know that their great-grandchildren are meeting in peace? And so that's the purpose of the documentary, to talk about this photograph that my grandfather took to meet these people, but then to dig deeper as to what it means about keeping these people alive.
For our last highlight clip, I chose some comments by the famous German-American architect, Dirk Lohan, who is also the grandson of another famous German-American architect, Mies van der Rohe. Dirk is still designing iconic buildings in Chicago, just as his grandfather did. And it's important to remember that Germans shaped the city of Chicago, both figuratively and literally. So here's Dirk talking about his experience being an immigrant in Chicago.
But I want to say one other thing. In the years that I've been here, I have always felt welcome. I've never had anybody say, go to hell or go back to where you came from. And I'm sure Helmut Jahn had similar experience. Americans, particularly in the Midwest, are friendly people. I have been extremely pleased and I admire the attitude of people in this country. I mean, think about it. Mies van der Rohe comes to America. He doesn't speak English. He uses 2 American Bauhaus students that spoke German to actually speak to students and to the university in the beginning a few years until he learned the English well enough to be able to do it himself. But here is a guy, the World War breaks out, and they make him a dean of a school who doesn't speak English and allow him to teach with translator help. It's amazing to me how generous that is. And then my own experience just proves it's a characteristic in America and the recent election of politics in this country. Because so many immigrants are trying to come into America is part of the long-standing history of immigration to this country. And I hope we can solve how we accept people in the coming years and in the future with a friendly and positive attitude. So, I mean, that's as far as I will go with politics.
Fine words to end. What a great guy. I really hope you enjoyed the series. These were just the highlights, and I hope you go back to listen to all of the episodes. There's so much to learn. There are many people that I'd like to thank for supporting the series. First, thank you to Douglas Cowie, the guest host, and all the fantastic experts who taught us so much about Chicago and Hamburg. A special thanks to Laura Langford, chair of the Amerikazentrum, Zara Altman, our government liaison and project coordinator, and the whole team at the Amerikazentrum. You guys are great. Thanks also to the German Foreign Ministry, the U.S. State Department, and the city of Hamburg for their support. And last but not least, thank you to all of the thousands of listeners who have subscribed to the series. The music was composed and performed by Wouter Verhulst, and it's such a great song, and our outstanding graphics were designed by Henning Christensen. The series was conceived, produced, researched, scripted, hosted, recorded, mixed, edited, and mastered by me, Andrew Sola. Whew. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.